Exhibition number 23221, Reel 7.
Major Mole, Reel 7. I think you were saying that you were normally accommodated in schools or rubber lines, and you were quite comfortably set up.
Yeah, we would have set up a volleyball. Men love volleyball and basketball, and they were tremendously keen on their games and things.
Were these company locations properly secured and defended?
I think they had. They weren't considered to be necessary to be. Just, I mean, the at that stage in the bandit or the communist insurgency, there hadn't been any cases by this time of. I mean, obviously we had sentries, etc., but they weren't. We didn't have slit trenches or anything like that. It wasn't that sort of. They were virtually in the town or villages, and so there wasn't that sort of threat.
You said that there was no contact for that 6 months when you were there with the support company commanding the platoon.
I think there may have been. I think we killed one or two bandits, but my platoon personally didn't. We were sort of patrolling, and they possibly come across tracks or something, but we didn't actually. But the battalion, I think, at that time, our battalion had the biggest number of kills in of any of the Gurkha battalions. And so, you know, there would be a certain amount of context. But the whole of this time, which I'm describing, I suppose, of the Malayan emergencies as opposed to the Borneo confrontation, I think in all the time, we were there, I personally, in all the, I think, 10 years on and off with periods in Hong Kong, I personally was only involved in one battle, as it were, one small battle. But the rest of the time, it was just the joy of commanding a company and tremendous spirit and the great, wonderful times we had. And as you say, they're constantly patrolling, different aspects of patrolling. As different brigadiers tried to get themselves, win their spurs, they would have new plans. At one stage, it was a question of going into deep, deep jungle for 6 weeks at a time, because it was thought that the bandits had moved a long way in and we had to try and find their bases. And so that was an interesting period and pretty unproductive. But later on, I became IO before I got my first company. And that was the time when we had quite an interesting. We'd moved to Johor by then. We used to have these periods of going back to Slim Barracks to retrain and then go up to a different area. After Selangor, we moved to Johor. And as I was saying, the signal officer was John Knott, subsequently Minister of Defence.
What sort of fellow was he?
He was a friendly guy, great fun. He was a sort of slightly intellectual officer. Nice fellow. And he and I were very good pals, and we still are. But we got information one day that that one of the regional commanders, I forget his name now, something like Lee Hon Fat or something, had... was in the area of some pepper states north of where we were. And there was very hot information that he was coming in to meet some informants to get a typewriter for his jungle press, and that he was going to be handed this over the next day. And I hadn't really time. I just got this hot information. So... the CO said I could take a patrol out. So we managed to get my old mortar platoon, a strong section for the mortar platoon, and a wonderful chap called Pratap Singh, who was second in command of that. And we set out at night, and we got into position in the pepper, near the pepper estate, where this this thing was meant to take place, and I remember getting concealing ourselves in quite good position. And as it dawn came, some women tapers came out. It was sort of rubber, come pepper, come lalang grass, quite an open area. And we were lying in this thick grass and off this rambutan orchard waiting. And unfortunately, the women came with a small boy. And the small boy wandered into our ambush. So we had to jump on him and hold him down, which didn't help matters particularly. And anyway, I think we let him go. I can't remember, because we couldn't just hold on to the boy. And anyway, these women moved off. We didn't hear very much or see much from quite everything. And then suddenly, there were two obviously communist terrorist CTs arrived near the ambush. And there was some firing. And then there was a sort of, they managed to get away, and there was a tremendous chase through the pepper. And then we got this chap, and we killed him and brought him in. And he was a very senior, one of the most senior bandit commanders in Johor that had been caught, so we had quite good information on him. And I remember we took him back, and we felt quite pleased we'd killed a bandit. I think we killed two. And the CO was quite scathing about it. He said, this man was wounded. Why did you have to kill him? We needed to go. And I said, well, we got him, and that's the end of it. CO at that time, Gerald Rickord had left by then, and there was somebody called Pat Kent command.
Do you know how the information on which you acted on that occasion had been acquired? What was the source of that intelligence?
That was definitely through the special branch, who had by that time beginning to work quite effectively, and the special branch had passed the information on. The map actually that was captured, that was on that chap, was subsequently framed and did hang in the mess, and then possibly maybe in the Gurkha Museum, I don't know now, but it was their map.
When you had your ambush, how was it laid out? What sort of ambush position did you occupy?
Well, there were only about six of us,
yes.
And I imagine we were just concealed as best we could be in this grass, etc., where we thought we had been told this handover was going to take place. But it's possible that these women coming into the position and the boy, etc., had disrupted the proper handover, and so the arrival of these chaps and some odd shouting, etc., confused the issue. So, in fact, it didn't turn out like none of these things ever do, according to plan.
Did the people you shot at, did the enemy, did they come into the position from the same direction or from different directions?
I think they came in rather as we'd expect them to come in. But it was all, you know, like all these things, it's a fleeting moment.
Yes.
And it's very confused, and it's difficult to be specific.
Do you know how many bandits there were, actually, in the area?
We think there were only two or three. I mean, this chap had been reported to have been wounded. I think it was the Fijis who are north of us.
Yes.
And he had been reported to be wounded. And that's why the CO was cross, because he said, you know, this chap was wounded and you shot him. And I said, well, he may have been wounded, but I don't know if he was previously badly wounded, but he certainly was. By the time we'd finished with him, we weren't going to have any known.
So you killed two, and who was
either one or two. I can't. Yes. I'm not sure if we killed two or not. I can't. I think it was one or two. I can't remember. We certainly killed the one. I think we killed the second one.
Well, you said that he had a map on him. Did he have anything else about of value or interest?
I can't. He was pretty scruffily dressed, and he didn't really have much on him. But I can't imagine. I can't remember really. And the special branch when we took the body back, they sort of took him off. So that was sort of the only personal contact I had in that Malayan emergency, and it's just indicative of the, you know, the amount of times and spent hours and hours and hours of patrolling, and hours of ambushing, etc. And my company, or the companies I commanded, didn't actually. I mean, I was nearly another period later on when I was commanding a company further along. I was very lucky not to be. I was coming back from an O group and at night in a ferret scout car. And as I came around the corner, there was no problem, etc. And I went to the base, and about 10 minutes later, just where I'd passed, a rubber planter was ambushed and killed, so they must have been in position when I came past. And I was subsequently thinking about it. I mean, there hadn't been much in the way of ambushes and things on the roads at night. I was sitting at the top of the ferret scout car, sort of swanning along in the lovely evening light, and of course, if they had done, I would have been probably ahead of it.
But presumably, you know, a scout car is a fairly hard target for...
Yes, I think they obviously wouldn't have, and they wouldn't have realised, you know, I mean, we had this gun and it was all mounted up and ready, so I mean, they would have been quite difficult for them to attack us. But they did, in fact, with this planter, they threw burning wood across or something, or grass or something. So as he came around the corner, he drove into a... sort of burning flames on the road, and that's how he stopped, how they stopped him, and then of course it was easy to kill him. I think it was a particular special thing. They wanted to kill this particular planter, and they probably didn't want to singe the Gurkha's tails.
Do you happen to remember why it was they were after this particular man?
No, I can't.
Mm. When you were IO, you mentioned you got information from Special Branch. Were there other sources of information that came into your...
No, we didn't have our own information sources at all. It was all through Special Branch. Very close relation. The CEO would meet every day with him. I remember one day we had a prisoner brought in at that particular time when I was still IO, a woman bandit, and she said that she would lead a company into the camp. She said she knew where the camp was and she was fed up with them and she was going to lead them. And we had a wonderful chap called Peter Richardson, who was a tremendously sort of misogynist sort of chap. He was terribly awkward with women and very shy, and he'd got a DSO earlier. He had the biggest kill. He killed 28 bandits in some incident. But so he was a tremendous sort of expert, but quite gruff and difficult sort of fellow. He didn't know how to behave at all with women. And I remember it was so funny because he was called in to town headquarters. The CEO gave him instructions, and there he went off with this woman bandit and an interpreter. Police corporal went off with him, and it was such a funny sight. This chap Peter Richardson having to go into the jungle with a woman. It wasn't successful. When they got in, they found the camp had gone. But a lot of towards that time, the information, the bandit threat had begun to weaken by then. It was really a question of searching for in a haystack, really.
Did you have personal contact with the police, or was it all done through the CO?
Nearly always through the CO, but I think we did from time to time. We used to go in.
Did you have an intelligence section or staff to help you?
I think I had a couple of intelligence corporals who worked with me. And basically, our job was to receive all the sit-traps in at night from the companies, wherever they were, plot on the maps where platoons were, where sections were, and keep the maps up so that at any one time the CEO would know where everybody was and what was happening. And everything was based on evening sit-traps coming in from the platoons, or from the companies.
Did the communications work effectively?
Yeah, no, they worked very well. I mean, it involved, and the radios were pretty odd in those days, but when you stopped it, if you had to communicate back, you had to sort of, the signalers had to erect quite lengthy aerials, which they would rig up in the trees. I mean, really quite long, I suppose. 50 yards long were these aerials, which they'd swing up in the trees. Somehow they managed to get them. And a lot of the messages were passed with using Morse code, still at that time. Certain amount of voice, sometimes it was code.
Did you bother to encode them, decipher them, or were they
no,
clear?
No, we didn't, no.
Did you have any support from the Royal Air Force? Photographs and things like that for in purposes.
Well, we had Osters, and We used to go and sort of do that, but you couldn't really see much. The only time, at one stage, I think we were still in Johor at that time, General Walter Walker, the famous General Walter Walker, that time was commanding our brigade, and he had great schemes by which he was going to win the war. Mm. And one of them was a splendid device. Well, the idea was to bomb. If you found a bandit camp, instead of attacking it, you'd bomb it with massive carpet bombing and kill all the bandits. That was the theory. And they devised a scheme by which you'd have a flare. So if you found a bandit camp, you carried this flare with you. It was a sort of secret flare. And then you would arrange to set this flare, say, 1,000 yards from the bandit camp, and with a direct line of a compass bearing from that to the camp. And then it had a sort of timer on it, and you'd set this off, and then the RAF would come in and bomb the hell out of the camp. That was the theory.
Do you know if the bombing attacks on the communist terrorist clearings were actually effective?
No, I don't think they were. I think it was just... one more idea of trying to involve the RAF and other people in the thing, trying to get it on the act. But no, I don't think they were. And the other thing was, of course, it did terrible damage when you went in where a few thousand-pound bombs had been dropped to look at the area. Of course, it was virtually impossible to see anything because of the... turned it off. Yeah. No, well, I think that the... as I say, when we did eventually go to one place where they had done it, it was impossible to see anything because the effect of 1,000-pound bombs on primary jungle is incredible. And you just... It's almost impossible to walk through it because there are trees everywhere, etc. So, but I suppose it was a possible idea.
Did Walter Walker have any other... particular ideas that he wanted to put into effect?
Well, I think Walter Walker felt, you know, that one should try all sorts of techniques because we'd all been... We were, by this stage in the emergency, which was we're talking about now, it's towards the... really, when there were not that number of bandits around, or CTs, and... it really was looking for needles in a haystack, and he rather thought that if you put sort of battalions in, and there was a chance you might flush them out. But I don't think it doesn't. I think towards the end it became apparent really that the only way of success with these people was through intelligence rather than by them coming forward and giving themselves up, or the thing system breaking down. But I don't think that the heavy hand of sort of artillery attacks and things like that could possibly work, I would say.
You mentioned cooperating with the Royal Air Force. Was there any sort of connection with the Royal Navy?
Not really. I don't think there was one operation early on when I was there on the Temenggong. No, not Temenggong. Pengerang Peninsula, which is the very southeastern corner of Malaya, and because it was a small peninsula, it was relatively easy to try, and there were meant to be quite a number of bandits in there to try and sort of cut it off at the top, and then sort of work through it and bombard parts of it. But I don't think it was very successful. It was a great plan, but there are lots of ways of getting off a peninsula if you know the way.
Do you think that the terrorists in Malaya were ever a serious threat to the country, or were they more of a dangerous nuisance?
Oh, I think before General Templer came along, I mean, I think there was a really serious possibility of the communist terrorists possibly taking over. I mean, they were very strong, and they were terrorizing it was basically, I suppose, in the rubber estates, where I don't know whether there were some, of course, in the cities as well, communists, but I'm really not sufficiently au fait to be able to say whether that really was. But I would have thought that there could well have been. After all, if you think about it, communism was moving its way right the way through that part of Southeast Asia at the time. And I believe personally that it was the strength of Gerald Templer's policies of enclosing people in villages and giving the villagers the courage to stand up and the wherewithal of refusing food to the bandits, because that was really the key to it. And setting up village defence units and things. But I think that was what really broke it eventually.
You mentioned that there were times when you had ambushes around the new villages to try and prevent deliveries of food to CTs. Did you ever actually catch anybody doing that?
I personally didn't, but I mean, I was spent hours and hours in ambush going in late at night, and we would sit around for hours, and it was very tedious. And it was based usually on information that some of the bandits were coming to a certain point in the war. We did have some success. I personally wasn't involved in anything, but there was some success with the odd one, but it just had to be done.
What sort of defences did these villages have? Were they substantial?
Yes, there were substantial were. Quite high were entanglements and fences round these villages. And I suppose that the bandits really met the tappers, the rubber tappers, in some remote part of the rubber estates whilst they were tapping. One couldn't be watching that all the time, and then you know they terrify them into saying you will get some food and deliver it at such and such a place. And they, you know, they were appalling if they did get in, and they would do terrible, terrible things to the Pengulu, the headman of the villages. They'd kill them, and so I mean it was a difficult time.
What was the state of affairs when you last left Malaya? Then had the bandit threat been eliminated completely?
I can't remember exactly when it was, but we had this rotation system in the Gurkhas, which we would spend 3 years every so often in Hong Kong. And at some stage during, towards the very end part of the Malayan emergency, I think our battalion moved back up to Hong Kong, and then the thing virtually ceased.
You said the next theatre in which you got involved in an active way was in Borneo. How did that happen?
Well, I had been on the staff in Faroe, and then after I went to the Belgian Staff College, and then after my staff appointment, I was due to go back to the battalion, by which time I was relatively senior, I suppose, as a company commander. And I wasn't involved in the Brunei revolt, in which the first, second were closely, very closely involved in the fighting, and successful outcome of that, preventing the revolt. So I joined at a later stage when the actual confrontation, which was separate to the Brunei revolt, was happening. So I joined the battalion. I was given a company in Capit, in Sarawak. This was, I think the battalion had just moved into, this was the second tour of the battalion, I think, in confrontation. And I had a command of this company in Capit, which was up in the 3rd Division of Sarawak.
What sort of ground was it at Capet?
Well, Capet was, we had a company base, Capet was the sort of provincial centre for the whole of the upcountry provincial centre for the whole of the 3rd Division. As you know, Srauk's divided into 5 divisions. And the 3rd Division is the largest, really controlled basically the movement along the Belui and the Bali rivers, which go right up in, right up into the heart of the 3rd Division. So it was very interesting. It was a very interesting time. We had about 50 Dayaks who were attached to us as trackers, and we had six. Some of the time we built a base for the helicopters, and we had six RAF helicopters around about Capet, and the sort of base there. They were the Wessex helicopters. So, and we had an area about the size of Wales, so it was very interesting.
How heavily populated was it?
Not heavily populated at all. At that stage, people were still living in the longhouses along the rivers. And it was basically longhouses up until you got to the end of the longhouses, and there was nothing but jungle.
Was this like the primary jungle in which you've been operating in Malaya?
Fairly similar. Yes, of course, there was not much rubber. I can't remember. I don't think there was any rubber around there. But so it was basically primary jungle. And a relatively easy primary jungle to walk in. And in the more remote parts of, up in the extreme parts of, up near the Indonesian border, the map information was non-existent, and it would just say no topographical information available. So it was quite interesting when you went up as far as that and started patrolling and sent back map references of a totally blank map of where you thought you'd reached. There was a few indications of where rivers might be. So that was fascinating.
So you were effectively explorers as well.
I felt one was.
How many men did you have in your company?
I think we had about 120 men, probably. It was quite a good, strong company, plus the helicopter lot and Dayaks, so it was quite a strong.
What weapons and equipment were they using for this work against confrontation?
It's just really basic, very much basically infantry. Simple company weapons. I mean, support weapons didn't come into it. It was just armalites, I think we had. I can't remember now.
Not the standard British weapon, then?
No, it was a standard British weapon. Yes, it was.
The armalite was American, wasn't it?
Yeah. No, well.
Stonewall system.
Yeah. It was just a standard weapon, nothing particular.
What about their uniforms and other equipment, personal kit? Was any of that specially adapted to local conditions?
Not really. It was just a continuation of the Malaysian campaign, really.
What did you actually have at the company base? What?
Well, we originally were in Capet itself, and then we moved up river in due course to a base which we made about, I think it was about 50 miles up the river, and we built a base. We had a base built completely for ourselves, which was built by the locals for us out of bamboo, and it was sort of bamboo bashers around the place, and it was really quite good. It wasn't frightfully brilliant from a defensive point of view, but it was convenient, and as subsequently turned out, when the Indonesians did actually do the odd attack, it would not have been a very good place to be in.
Did you have any sort of defensive perimeter?
Oh yes,
wire or anything like that?
No, we didn't have wire, but we had sort of defensive positions and OPs and things around it. At night we had a standing patrol up on the hill and that sort of thing. But no, I mean, We were quite a long